Now, but it's time for us to begin. It's a lot of material to cover tonight, and it's a very deep subject. But the most important thing is to make it easy and easy to understand, and try to simplify it as much as possible. Okay, so tonight we're going to be talking about Islam. We talked last week about Jewish religion, okay? But tonight we're going to talk about Islam, and there's a lot of material to cover. So I'll try to simplify as much as I can, and sometimes I tend to go deeper than I would like to. But let's see what we can do and just get the major points and in this about 50 minutes we have, 45 minutes. Okay, so beginning in Genesis 12, yeah, from our Bible, we have in Genesis 12, chapter 3, and in just Genesis 12, the beginning, how God is going to bless Abraham. And we have in verse 3, I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Okay, we have this blessing promise made to Abraham. We're later going to learn from where that blessing is going to come, from the seed of Abraham and who that seed is. But then, as we move along in the book of Genesis, Genesis chapter 16, we're going to see that Abraham and Sarai, at this time his wife, had no children. Okay? And then, but Sarah had an Egyptian, a maid servant. What was her name?
Hagar.
Hagar, yes. Keep in mind she was from Egypt because they're going to return back to Egypt in a few years later. Okay, so we see Sarai said to Abraham, "See now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her." And Abraham heeded to the voice of Sarai. Then Abraham's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband, Abraham, to be his wife. Keep in mind, by this time, the promise had already been given to Abraham, okay, about them having a child. So, you know, they're taking a different direction right here. And then we see the outcome of this event. And she conceived right after Hagar conceived. Now the quarrel began between them. Okay, she started looking, giving different look to her, to Sarai, and then Sarai, called to Abraham, "Why wrong be upon you? I gave you my maid into you to embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, I became despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between you and me." So Abraham said to Sarah, "Indeed, your maid is in your hands. Do to her as you please." And when Sarah dealt harshly with her, she fled from her presence. Okay, this is Genesis 16 now. Genesis 17, verse 23 and on, we see that Abraham took Ishmael, his son, and it's time for them to be circumcised. And Ishmael, if I'm not mistaken, according to the text, he was already 8 years old. 13 years old when he was circumcised in his flesh. Abraham was 99. But that very same day, Abraham was circumcised when he received that instruction from God. Now, what happened to Hagar in Genesis 21, we see that she was expelled from the camp, from where Abraham and Sarah lived. And then verse 20, Genesis 21, "And God heard the voice of the lad. Then the angel of God called Hagar out of heaven and said to her, 'What ails you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad and hold him up in your hand, for I will make him a great nation.'" And that promise was fulfilled. "I will make him a great nation." It wasn't taken lightly from God that he came from Abraham. You know, Abraham was special to God. So then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. And she went and filled the skin of the water and gave the lad to drink. Very interesting that nowadays Muslims believe that this place, this fountain of water, is still there in Mecca. And there's two mountains from which Hagar ran back and forth, according to them, based on this story. And those two pieces of mountain, I don't know, they may be separated from each other by maybe half a mile or so. when pilgrims go to Mecca, they reenact that run back and forth that supposedly Hagar did. Okay, so nowadays you can find videos in YouTube. You can see that people recording those type of events, and you see them reenacting. But we'll get to that in just a few minutes. Okay, so so we see he dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. Excuse me, sorry. Let's see. All right. Took a wife from the land of Egypt for him. Now in Genesis, well, we're going to stop there on this Bible account. Now, Muslims believe this account. Okay, they believe it, and this is they trace their history, you know, back to Abraham. And anyone before Abraham, they also acknowledge. Okay, but we'll get to that in just a moment. So we fast forward about 1,500 years later or more. If we're taking this from Abraham, it's probably 2,500 years later. But anyways, in AD 57, 570 years, you know, by this time a lot had happened already with Christianity and so on and so forth. And, you know, by this time Catholicism was moving about, and it's late, 570. It's a lot of years before, after the establishment of the church, that this happened. This is, for us, significant for us to keep in mind. But in this year, that's when, in the vicinity of Mecca, which is in Arabia nowadays, and the city is still called Mecca nowadays, that's where Muhammad was born, okay? And in this area, at this time when he was born, the religion in that place was a mixture of polytheism and also animism. Animism is those who believe that inanimate objects have conscience, like trees and rocks and so on and so forth. And so there was a lot of idolatry. Okay? So we see that he was born in that environment. It was very polytheistic. And then as he grew up later on, when he was 25 years old, Muhammad, he was hired by this widow, and her name was Khadija. And eventually he married her, okay, this wealthy widow. And then he became to lead caravans, you know, from that part of Arabia up to the Holy Land, or Jerusalem, rather, going down to the northern part of Africa. Okay, so in these routes, keep in mind, by this time, you know, Christianity had been, Judaism is still existing, and Christianity is still existing in different forms, okay, Catholicism and so on, just taking that word in general. And so he begins to hear stories, you know. He comes from a place where there's a lot of idols, and then he begins to hear stories, and also remember that there was no scripture written in Arabic at that time, so everything he heard were stories from travelers, and who communicated orally. So he began to pick pieces, bits and pieces, and then so he begins to hear about the one God. And he likes that idea of being monotheistic instead of polytheistic. Okay, so in 595, he marries this wealthy widow named Khadija. And then after that, in 610, as we move along a few years later, he was meditating in this place, which is called the Mount. Right now it's called Mount Hira, or it's called also the Mount of Light, which overlooks, you know, the plain of Mecca. And that's where he was meditating in this place. And then he claims that the angel Gabriel, you know, with the bright light, appeared to him and said, recite. That's the first word he told him, recite. Okay, that's where the word Quran comes from. Recite is a verb, and Quran is a noun from the same verb, which means recitation. That's what the word Quran means. So he became to recite. Also remember, he was illiterate. He did not know how to write or read, okay, according to history. So he begins to memorize what supposedly Gabriel is telling him. Okay, he begins to memorize these sayings or these instructions. And that night, when, you know, when Gabriel appeared to him, is known by Muslims as the night of power or the night of destiny until this day, and is celebrated on the 27th of the month of Ramadan, which is a very important month for the Muslims nowadays. So the first recitation is now the first five verses of the in the Quran, that first recitation that he had. Right, so basically what his message, there were three main points in the message he received. There's only one God. Number two, human beings are obligated to submit to God. And then number three, there will be a day of judgment when all people will be assessed whether they or not obey God, or Allah in this case. Which is a better word to put it, Allah. That's the way they call him, or the word they use. Okay? So eventually Muhammad gained a group, get popularity in the city of Mecca. But if you know, if it's a polytheistic city, and then you begin to teach that there's one God, that did not sit well with the people of Mecca, so he was asked to leave the city. Okay, he became to be oppressed or persecuted, and he gained followers. You know, his wife, right off the bat, she believed him, and then they began to gain followers. So what they had to do, they had to flee to another city. But, and then he continued to receive revelations in that city. But in 622, okay, that's when they decided to leave Mecca for the city in the north, which eventually was named Medina, which means city of the prophet. Okay, and they call this transition the Hijra. Okay, and this fleeing of the city is so important to them that the calendar was reset today to year zero on that time when he fled with his followers to the city of Medina, which began, you know, marked the day when the Muslim, you know, faith began. Okay? So, moving along, he was faithful to his wife, and he only had one wife. Well, he was married to Khadijah. But in 619, she died. Okay, but after her death, that's when things changed for him, because according to him, he was given permission, and according to the Quran, as we will learn, men are permitted to marry as many as four wives if they can provide, according to the Quran, they can provide economically, and if they can love him equally, that's what it says. Right, so, but he was given an exception. And the exception was that he can marry more wives if he wanted to. So he ended up marrying as many as 11 wives. You know, there's debate as far as the number. But there's a couple of those wives that really caused trouble for him. One of them was named Aisha. And this girl was only 5 years old when she married him. And the marriage was consummated when she was 9. Okay? So we see this, Muslims try to justify this because they say, first of all, polygamy was accepted back in those days. And then arranging marriages like that also was accepted. That's the way they see it. Okay? But that's a fact that cannot be denied. Later, you know, he had only four daughters. He never had a son. Okay? Only daughters. And, you know, they got married and they lived to adults. But he adopted a son. Okay? And what happened is he ended up, you know, his son divorced his wife. And guess who took his son's ex-wife? Muhammad took this lady, Zainab, to be his wife. And that caused trouble because for two things. Zainab was her paternal cousin. Okay, paternal cousin. She was the daughter of his father's sister. Okay, and in that culture, or according to the Islam, it's okay to marry your maternal cousins. You know, the ones who come from your mother. It's okay, but not the ones that come from your father. And that's the first issue with this wife. And then also, you know, he's marrying the ex-wife of his son. So how do they fix this? Well, he received further revelation where one of the things he was told was that when the prophet was told something, just to take the matter as just settled. Don't inquire more about it. And if Allah said that it was okay for him to do it, it's okay. And then, now, how do you account for marrying the ex-wife of your son? Okay, in this case, your ex-daughter-in-law. Well, what happened is that in the Quran, Muhammad received further revelation where he was told that the adoption of his son was not legal in the eyes of Allah. So they discredited that adoption, and that way he was free to marry his son's daughter. Okay? And to this day, Muslims will not adopt. Okay? That's something that comes from that. Okay? And much less, they will not let, their orphan children to be adopted by Christian parents. They will not allow that either. Okay? Of course, I'm talking in general, especially in those countries, which is about 50 countries where are, predominant Muslim by law. Okay? So this comes from that. So his life began, on the wrong foot, you will see, with his issues with the wives. And then further revelation was given to him that he was okay for him to take more wives, that it was an exception only to him, but not to the followers. Okay? That's part of the Quran. But anyways, in the year 620, a year after his wife died, there's something called the night journey from Mecca to Jerusalem, where it is believed that he riding on this horse, winged horse, his name was Burak, he flew all the way to Jerusalem. And in Jerusalem, right in Mount Moriah, the place where supposedly Abraham was to sacrifice Isaac, he went up into the heaven, in fact, to the seventh heaven, and he met with God, and then he came down the next morning. And this place, when you go to Jerusalem, you see the Dome of the Rock, or you see, in pictures on the internet, and in this dome inside is the place where Muhammad, set his foot to fly into heaven, according to that story. Okay, and then they fled to Medina. They changed the name of this town, but then after being oppressed, after being persecuted in his hometown Mecca, now that he gains followers in Medina, begins to control the city of Medina, begins to get more adepts and convert people. And we're going to learn that he converted by the sword. He will go to these routes and either you convert or die. Okay, and that's a history fact. Okay, so after he gained, army enough, now he said, well, after all, my hometown people, they did me wrong. I'm going to go back and get them. So you see how the oppressed now, as soon as he can, he becomes now the oppressor. And now he goes back to the city of Mecca and now begins to fight. He was, of course, at first outnumbered, but nonetheless, he began to win battles, and that gave him the popularity of being a true prophet from Allah, according to what he said. All right, so he conquers that city of Mecca, and then he goes in the Mecca. There is a cube, a rock cube, which was filled with idols, about 360 idols, you imagine. And then also among those idols, there's a rock, a meteorite that fell from the sky. And they had it, and they considered it a goddess, okay? And so he goes back into this cube, which in Arabic is called Mecca, and into this day, that's the word is used to describe that place. And nowadays, it's not bare like it was before. Now it's covered by some, black clothing, and with Arabic letters and so on. And so he cleanses that place, takes all the idols away, except for that meteorite. It's still there to this day. And, people, when they do their pilgrimages, one of the high points of the pilgrimage is to be able to reach and touch that meteorite, that rock, okay? So he comes back, he conquers Mecca, of course, and then he died in 632. That's when he died. Now, very interesting that the Bible was not translated into Arabic until after 700 AD. And so there's no scripture here to teach these people. Everything was oral. So, Muhammad, I think about this religion you know, there was a prophecy that false Christs will arise, you know, and some of them, and most of them, in fact, were, you know, really subdued by the Romans back in those days, and they disappeared, they died, okay? But he was in the right place at the right time for, if we can call it like that, where it picked up movement, it picked up followers. And of course, if you're going to be, if you don't have a strong faith, and then you're, you know, threatened to be killed by the sword or convert, I think it's going to be very tempting just to convert and just, you know, keep on living. So that's what happened, all right, with them. And they had that to their benefit. Okay, so after he dies, you know, there's a division of the groups. Okay, one of them want to appoint as the successor or caliph, they call it, Muhammad's. One of them want to put Muhammad's father-in-law. Okay, and the other group wants to put, you know, he had a daughter named Fatima, and he had a son named Ali, and the other group wants to name Ali the successor. Okay, so what happened is there were three successors after he died. And the fourth successor was Ali, finally Ali. But by the time Ali was named a successor, they, you know, the other group which waited for Ali to be named, you know, three generations or three peoples, three persons, they were very resentful against the majority who appointed the other successors who they do not think they were legal successors or rightful successors. But anyways, there was already a lot of division, you know, in Arabia, in that part, there were tribal, you know, rivalries and divisions already, okay? So this was part of their, you know, culture. So they divided among these, and one of them are called the Sunnis, and the other ones are called the Shiites, okay? And the Shiite means only, you know, the consensus, that's what it means, that word. So the majority of the Shiites... Excuse me, the Sunnis are the majority and the Shiites are the minority. So there's a lot of story about behind all of that division of the Sunnis and the Shiites. But the Shiites, let's see, which are the minority, they're placed more in Iran and Iraq. Okay? And the Sunnis, you know, are mostly everywhere else that there's Muslims. Something interesting to keep in mind, and let me mention this fact here. There's about, by this time, there's about probably 1.5 billion Muslims in the world. But something interesting, only 20% of the world's, you know, more or less, of the world's Muslims are Arabs. You see, this is something, you know, interesting to consider. For instance, keep in mind Indonesia. They're not Arabs. It's a nationality. That's the biggest Muslim country. Okay? So also Arabic is maybe the fifth or sixth most spoken language in the world. Okay? But as we keep on going, we see the division. Let me just go to some of the facts that they believe. You know, we have the Quran and this Quran, as we have it, you know, as we have it today, was collected by the first, second, third successor after Muhammad. Okay? His name was Uthman, and he was the third caliph after Muhammad. And he's the one who gathers all of these sayings of Muhammad and writes it down. Muhammad did not write anything because, you know, he was illiterate. Yes?
I was going to ask that. When did the Quran actually come in play? Was he keeping all this stuff in his head, or what, did he have scribes or manuscripts to write these things down?
That's a good question. What they say is that he memorized it, and he would recite it back to all of his followers. And, you know, they kept it in their minds, they memorized it. And to this day, you know, I have here a small copy that I have of the Quran. It's a Spanish version. Mm-hmm. I thought it was English version when I put it out. I said, Spanish, okay. So, but it's I have a couple of verses I want to read anyways, but I'll translate them for you. But but the Muslims, not until today, one of their goals is to memorize the whole Quran. Okay. Now, if you read it, I don't know if some of you have read. I've read parts of it only. But you can tell, if you are, you know, seasoned with reading the scripture, you can tell the difference. You can tell it's man-made. Okay? It's easy to tell, you know, because there's, you know, there's, he got enough, you know, enough ideas from the Bible, from the Jewish beliefs, to incorporate into his sayings, but he never, not all the time he got the facts right, you know. And, you know, one of the things they do not like is the Trinity, the word Trinity. They despise that word because they consider it idolatry, polytheism. And that's the worst sin you can commit according to the Quran. It seems like according to the Quran that Muhammad believed that Mary was part of the Trinity. Because in one of these surahs, which is a chapter that they have, there's 114 chapters, and in the Quran they're aligned from the most content to the least content. Okay, so as you move forward, the chapters are going to get smaller and smaller. Okay, so let me see if I have the right number here. Okay, there's in Surah 5 and verse 116, we see here Allah talking to Jesus. I haven't read the context. I don't know when and where was it, if it was in heaven or somewhere else. But he called Jesus, Allah called Jesus. He says, Jesus, son of Mary, are you the one who has been telling men, take us, myself and my mother, as gods, along with God, or with Allah? And then he answered, Jesus answered, glory to you. How am I going to be able to say that that is not true? Okay? If I had said it, you would have known it. You know everything that is in me, but I do not know what is in you. You are the one who knows the deep things, the hidden deep things. And that's the 17th verse. I have not told him only but what you have told me to tell. Okay? I don't know if you were reading, Mike, it's more or less that. More or less.
So, that was pretty much it.
In general. So you know, Muhammad believed that Mary was, that, you know, part of the Trinity. You know, he got those facts wrong. But anyways, as we move along on this, and also you're going to see mentioned here in the Quran, the people of the book. He's going to talk about the people of the book, and he's making a reference to Jews and to Christians. And at first, you know, they say that it's hard to put the surahs in order, in chronological order, but at first, he is, you know, he talks about the people of the book as people who are going to make it to heaven. But then later, he changes his mind, and he's going to say the people of the book are going to be condemned to hell. See? So you're going to see those two thoughts on the same book. Okay? Like he changed his mind. At first he was fond of Jewish and Christians, but then later on, as they oppose him or whatnot, or he learned about the so-called Trinity and things that he did not like, then he begins to condemn them. Okay? And it's part of the same book. But anyways, that's the Quran. I mean, let me see the time. I don't want to take too long. Okay? We still have time. So, they're very interesting that I have to hear the Quran in Spanish and Mike has it in English. It's not really authoritative in a translation. If you really want to, you know, be authoritative with that, you need to go back to Arabic language. That's the language in which you need to read it, okay, in order to understand it just like it is, you know. And I can see how that can be difficult for a lot of those, the followers. But anyways, some of the essential beliefs that they have, okay, is the oneness of God. And this brings to mind the Unitarian, or they're called, I forgot the name they're called with nowadays, one of these religions, but they're also Unitarian, okay, apostolic, that's the word. And they believe that God consists of only one person, okay? They cannot conceive the idea of there being three persons in the Godhead. And also, you know, the word Trinity was coined, it's not in the Bible, it's better to say the Godhead or deity. But we know from scriptures that deity is one deity. There's three persons that share that deity. So there's not any polytheism or worshiping of three different gods. Okay? as we will learn. But that's something very important for them. Now, the question comes, okay, and I want to be honest, I need to do more research about it, but it has been said that the Allah, you know, from the background that they have, and the idolatry background, and how important the moon is for the Arab people. In fact, the calendar that they have is a lunar calendar instead of a solar calendar, which means there are less days in their calendar. And, you know, they celebrate the month of Ramadan. That month, in a person's lifetime, that month of Ramadan will circle around the year at least twice. So you one day you celebrate in the middle of the summer. A few years later, you're going to be right in the middle of winter celebrating the same festivity because of there's 11 days shorter than the solar year. But anyways, it has been said that Allah is an idol, the moon god, okay? And whether or not it is, I'm not going to go to that point, but here's the question I want to answer, okay? Do Christians and Muslims worship the same God? That's the question. And the answer, plain and clearly, is no. Because what they're teaching, what Allah is teaching, and what God teaches, is a contradiction. So they cannot be right at the same time. Either, you know, either one's right and one is wrong. So it's not the same one, okay? And, you know, taking away the Son, taking away the Holy Spirit from deity, that's not the God of the Bible. Okay? That's not. It's just not. And what the Allah teaches is not the same thing as God teaches. Okay? So that question is important for us to keep in mind. Okay? So they believe in angels and spirits. They believe in prophets. Very interesting that they consider Adam, Noah, Abraham, David, and Jesus as prophets. Okay? They consider them prophets. And I wonder... where did Muhammad get the idea that Jesus was only a prophet? From his fellow Jews. Okay, who believed the same thing? You see, they believe he was only a prophet. Alright? So he said they believe he's only a prophet. Okay? Now, he believes in Moses. He says Moses was a prophet. Okay? Abraham was a prophet. Noah was a prophet. Adam was a prophet. But if Moses taught something different than Muhammad taught, why does the Quran mention them? Why do the Muslims believe in all of these prophets? Well, they believe in them, but the way they explain the Bible, the Old Testament scriptures, and the Christian scripture, New Testament writings, is that they are corrupted beyond repair. And unfortunately, the uncorrupted version has been lost and will never be able to be found. Okay, that's the way they're going to explain it. Okay, now, if you go to YouTube, you can see there's videos from by Dave Miller about is the Bible corrupted or not? And I think that's something important for us to, you know, to keep our minds on that topic, whether the Bible is corrupt or not. And, you know, he's going to explain. Now, of course, other people can do, I have done that before, but that's something I found on YouTube that can be useful for further study. But anyways, as we keep on moving, they believe in the judgment, okay? They believe there's going to be a day of judgment. There's going to be punishment in hell. There's going to be heaven or paradise, as they teach it. Okay, so what is the basis of their judgment? The basis for their judgment is just submission to Allah's will. That's what Islam means, submission. Okay, so those who are practice Islam are those who submit to the will of Allah. Okay, so no question asked, you submit. That's what you need to do, submit. And according, if you submit it correctly, then you will be rewarded at the end. And by the way, while Jews see following God out of love, out of respect, Muslims see it more as the reward. There's going to be a reward in heaven. There's going to be pleasure, a paradise, okay? Or there's going to be a punishment. That's the way they see it, okay? So that's one of the main differences, you know, in the view of the afterlife for them, okay? And then something interesting is that they don't have any assurance they're going to heaven. If you say, well, I'm a Muslim, I've been submitting, I've been faithful Muslim, and if you say, well, I know I'm going to heaven if I die, that is boastful. So they do not have this assurance, and they consider it presumptuous to have this attitude, because God is the only one who dictates what's going to happen to you. You see, in the New Testament, Christians, we have this assurance. And it's not boastful to say, I know where I'm going when I die. That's part of the blessings that we have by being Christians. Okay? So that's something for us to consider. Now, moving along, try to go as fast as I can. They have several, basic faith blocks that they have. But they also have five major pillars, in their practice. And these five pillars, summarize all of what they believe. One of the pillars is the confession, okay, which I call Shahada. This confession, basically, all you have to do is say it sincerely, and then you become a Muslim. All you have to do, say it sincerely. And the confession is, there is no God. I have the word God here, but it is Allah. There is no Allah but Allah, and Muhammad is the apostle of Allah, okay? So this first part, there is not Allah but Allah, is an assertion of this fundamental Unitarian religion that they have. And then the second part, there is no Muhammad is his apostle, okay? That is where they give, this credit to Muhammad, okay? And where everything he said or recited, that later was written down by his followers, okay? So that's the first pillar of the Islam, and in fact, this shahada is the first thing the baby hears when he's born, and is the last thing a person wants to hear or utters from his lips when he dies. This hashada. Okay, there is no God, there is no Allah but Allah, and Muhammad is the apostle of Allah. Okay, so it's a fundamental keystone for them. Now, the other thing is the prayer. Okay, they have prayer, salat. So each Muslim is supposed to pray five times a day. Okay, and then one of them is at sunrise, and then the other one is at noon, third one is at mid-afternoon, then at sunset, and then 1 hour after sunset, okay? And then they're supposed to pray. Now, when Christians go to Muslim countries, they're going to start hearing these bells or these, loudspeakers every now and then, and that's because it's the call from the mosque to pray, okay? And they do it for two reasons. One, so that people can come and pray at the mosque. Or if you're working at your place of work, most likely if you live in a Muslim country, they're going to give you a break to pray. Everybody's going to pray. And they can pray where you are. Okay? And everything they do is faced towards the city of Mecca. Okay? And every mosque and every Muslim prayer, they bow down towards the city of Mecca. Okay? That's the prayer. Very interesting, when you go to a Muslim mosque, okay, which I had the privilege to be into a couple of them, and then one of them, there was no worship service, it was just to, to look around and ask questions, and the other one was on a Friday night, okay, and Friday nights for Muslims are special nights, okay, and no matter where they are in the world, and so they try to get off of work early, to make it for the late evening, I think it's the sunset one, and so they're gonna, as you come to the mosque, they're gonna have a place, to wash. They wash their ears, their eyes, their mouth three times. They do like a ritualistic washing, and then they take it to the shoes off, and you come to a room. Where it's just basically an empty room. There's not going to be any images or anything, maybe some decoration. But it's going to be with carpet. And sometimes carpets have, in the colors of the carpet, they're going to be colored with lines so that people can array in lines, in straight lines, and then leaves room for the next line. So as they're coming in on Friday night, there's a sermon being delivered. And I had the privilege to see this. Back in those days, YouTube was not as prominent as it is right now. Okay, I'm talking about 2005. And so I recorded parts of it. I wish I had a projector to put that. That was kind of bold on my part, but anyways, I was able to do it. No one told me not to do it, so I did it. So you're going to see, you know, a room packed full of, you know, Muslims on a Friday night. I know it's a Friday night because there's a sermon. Any other time they come for prayer, there's not going to be a sermon, okay? But this time, what they call sermon, okay? And then after this message is delivered, they do their ritualistic prayer where they, you know, the first thing they do is they stand up, you know, with their ears like this, in a symbol that they're listening. And then they're going to, you know, bow down like this. And then they sit down on the floor. And then they kneel on the floor. And then they, you know, bow down and touch the foreheads on the carpet. They do that twice. And, you know, there's an imam, what they call imam. He's the leader, and he's chanting, and he's, every time he mentions Allah, that's the signal for them to do the same, the next movement. And they know what they're doing. And usually on Friday nights, the family comes, you know, they let the kids wander around the mosque. But the women, since they bow down, you know, and there's, you know, as you touch your forehead on the floor, of course I wasn't doing that, I was mainly just watching and recording. I was with a group of students. And so the women, they pray separately. They're in a section in the corner, and they don't mingle with the men. And but that's on Friday night, that's when most of the families come together. Usually during the week and other days, it's mostly men that come. But as you go in the entrance, you're going to see the lobby just pile full of shoes everywhere. Sandals, shoes, tennis, whatever. It's all, you know, it's a big pile. And I'm like, I wonder how you can find your shoes again, you know, among all this, you know, big mountain of shoes. But anyways, as I keep on going, okay, so we have the prayer. We have also fasting. They also fast. In the month of Ramadan, it's a month of fasting. This is a special month for them because that's when they fled from Mecca to Medina, and, you know, Muslim officially started, and they fast for the whole month during the daylight. Okay, they don't fast, you know, throughout the whole month. They, as soon as it's daylight, you know, they usually wake up for early breakfast when it's still dark, and they eat well, you know, and then they fast. And this means they're not going to take any sip of water, not one drop of water. They're not going to, of course, they're not going to eat anything all the way until sundown. So it depends on when the month of Ramadan falls. If it falls in the winter, shorter days. If it falls in the summer, longer days. So this means they abstain from doing exercise. They abstain from, you know, anything that will take away from your stamina, you know, so you can endure the day. Of course, they also keep themselves away from any, you know, sexual relationships, okay? That's what they do in this month of Ramadan, okay? Now, they also have the almsgiving. They give, you know, to the poor is something voluntarily, but in some countries with the Sharia law, which is the law that came, you know, from the interpretation of the Quran, and these states have taken it as law, as like, you know, like Indonesia. Well, Indonesia is not completely on the Sharia law, but other places like Arabia, Iraq, Iran, and so on, they have these laws that come from the Quran, the interpretation of the Quran, and this almsgiving has become more like a tax, okay? Something from law, okay? It has become a law, okay? Now, that's the fourth pillar, okay? So we've seen, we have the confession, we have the prayer, we have the fasting, we have the almsgiving, and the fifth one of them is the Hajj, which is the once upon a lifetime, every Muslim has to go, if it's possible, go to take a pilgrimage to the city of Mecca. Okay, and then they do some different things when they go there. They, for instance, when they get there, first thing there's arrival and preparation. You have to get ready for what you're going to do, the pilgrimage. Then the second thing they do is what they call the tawaf, which is to walk around seven times around this cube or Kaaba that has, and then many people want to touch, you know, the Kaaba itself and want to touch the rock, you know, that meteorite still there. And then the third thing they do when they do this pilgrimage, they run, you know, like I mentioned, from these two mountains where Hagar supposedly run back and forth, and they do this in that part of the pilgrimage. Then the fourth thing they do, it's one of the highest festivities they have, Al-Hajj, which is in the ninth day of the month, where they they go out to, they leave the city of Mecca, they go to a nearby town, and then they, from the afternoon prayer until dawn, until, you know, when it's night, they stand up, you know, in a place, reading the Quran, and meditating on it, and so on and so forth, you know, for several hours. And this is something, this is the, you know, the highlight of this trip, or this pilgrimage that they take to Mecca. And then something else they do, they also do sacrifices at the city of Mina. You know, they, I guess they buy livestock, you know, goats and stuff, and they sacrifice them. And this is to remember the sacrifice that, you know, remember the story of Abraham and Isaac? Well, you know, they believe the Bible is corrupted. They believe the Jews changed the name Ishmael for the name Isaac. So they believe the story of Abraham, but except that it was Ishmael who was being, was about to be sacrificed. So they do sacrifices in honor of that, you know, animal that was sacrificed instead of Ishmael. Okay? And then the last thing they do is they do a tawaf again. They do, well, something else they do is they, there's some columns, and they throw stones at the columns because these columns represent the devil. Okay? They do that when they do this pilgrimage. And the last thing they do, they go around the Kaaba 7 times again. Okay? And but I want to finish with this. You know, when it comes to all must confess that Allah is the only God, the Bible says in Exodus 6:3, I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty. But my name, Lord, I was not known to them. Okay? You see. And then Exodus 20, verse 2 and 3. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. Okay? This is what the Bible says. Now, concerning Muhammad as his prophet, okay? We, as I mentioned, Mark 13 and verse 22, it says that false Christ and false prophets will rise and show signs and wonders to deceive possible even the elect. Okay? And then 1 John 4:1 says, Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits whether they're of God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world. Okay? And then in Acts 3, 22 and on, we see this, this mention of Moses mentioning this prophet who will be raised up from among your brethren, him you shall hear in all things whatsoever he says to you. And it shall be that every soul who will not hear that prophet shall be utterly destroyed from among the people. It's talking about Christ. Okay? He is the prophet. He is God's son. Okay? To Christ. And then Galatians 1:9, as we have said before, so now we say again, if anyone preaches any other gospel than that which you have received, let him be accursed. Okay? Now, concerning the Quran being God's revelation from heaven, we remember Galatians 1:6. I marvel that you are so soon removed from him who called you into the grace of Christ to a different gospel. Okay? And then John 12:48. He who rejects me and does not receive my words has that which judges him. The word that I have spoken will judge him in the last day. Okay? And then concerning the angel Gabriel, which I was the angel who spoke to, according supposedly spoke to Muhammad in that, you know, back in Mecca, Galatians 1:8. But even if we or an angel from heaven preaches you any other gospel that you have received, let him be accursed. Okay, and then Jude said in verse 3, Beloved, while I was with you, in the latter part of that verse says, the faith that has once for all being delivered to the saints. Okay? So, you know, we can go back to the Bible to assess some of these doctrines that have, you know, come through the to Muhammad and so on. Okay? But any comments before we finish? Yes.
Yeah, I was curious.
Yes, please.
I was thinking about was that Muhammad and his ex-daughter-in-law, if I can say it that way. Was it Muhammad or Allah?
Okay, it was Muhammad.
Muhammad,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And I was thinking that if they just heard the law according to Leviticus 18, verses 14 through 18, then he would not have had her. He would not have even looked upon her, because you couldn't even look at their nakedness, let alone marry them.
Yes.
You know, and so whether it was paternal or maternal, it didn't matter.
Yes.
You're supposed to be looking upon it. And but then I thought about, it makes more sense why Muslims hate Christians, because they think that it was Ishmael and not Isaac. And they know that Christians believe that the Bible teaches that Isaac is the promised seed that Jesus came from. But they're saying, no, Ishmael is the promise that Allah came from.
Yes.
So they don't even look at Christ as being authoritative or God, just correct, some great man, a prophet.
Correct.
And so it makes more sense to me now. I think you helped me to make more connections today with this study than I've had on my own in many years. So I appreciate it.
Well, I hope so. I mean, it's a topic we don't study every day, you know, so it's I think it's important.
Well, we can see where they're coming from.
Yes.
And if we can get them to see that, no, it was Isaac and not Ishmael.
Yes.
Then maybe we might win one or two.
Correct. Yes. And the other thing, you know, Christ being deity is something they cannot conceive. But I can say maybe in general, in some areas of Christianity, not everybody understands that correctly anyways. So I'm not justifying anybody, but it's an important topic for every Christian to understand the deity of Christ,
right.
You know, that there's a oneness, yes, according to the Old Testament and in the Bible, there's oneness in essence.
Right.
Not in number, but in essence. But there's three persons who share that essence. Like in human, you know, human beings, there's only one, you know, essence of human beings. You know, everybody's human here in this room. But there's several different personality or persons. Okay, same thing we can say with angels. Okay, there's the angelic realm, or the angelic essence, we can say, or nature, if I can call it that. But there's many different persons in the angelic nature that share that. So me as a human, I'm not angelic in nature. I'm not divine in nature. I'm human in nature. Okay, so that's something, you know, for us to study further. But anyways, there's a lot of information that we can go in these topics. You see, they permit polygamy as long as there's four wives. I think about it, they say, as long as you can provide for them equally. Well, anybody can provide for them equally. You have to do is divide your check in four parts, and that's it. Yeah? No matter how you earn. So, and then how you assess whether you can love them equally, that's something that, how can you assess that? See what I'm saying? So anyways, they did not believe Jesus died on the cross because they think that's so cruel for Allah to do. No prophet from Allah should deserve such a horrible death. So they say, well, the Jews were beguiled, or were, you know, they were made to think that he was Jesus who was being crucified, but in fact it was not Jesus. So that's, you know, that's a explanation difficult to understand. You know what I'm saying? How can a lot of people can think that he's Jesus, but then he's not? You see? So they don't think, they don't believe in the crucifixion, more or less in the dying of one man for the atonement of everybody's sins. They don't think that's how Allah, you know, that's part of his character. They don't think that's like that. Okay, and then, but anyways, 1 Thessalonians 5:17, pray without ceasing. You know, we're free to pray anytime we want to pray, and as much as we want to pray, anywhere we want to pray. And that's concerning the five times of prayer. So anyways, we ran out of time, and there's a lot of material to cover. Hopefully I spark, you know, more interested in, you know, learning more about it. Thank you.